Hello and welcome back to Building Our Future with me, Bert Broadhead. It's probably not surprising that an era of huge upheaval in the built environment has coincided with a surge in great books relating to the subject. The latest in this line is Dror Pollaegh's Rethinking Real Estate, where the author explores the fundamental changes affecting the built environment, from the root causes to the now and future effects. I was lucky enough to catch up with Dror prior to the book's launch. My guest today is Dror Pollaegh, the author of the upcoming book, Rethinking Real Estate, and the co-chair of the Urban Land Institute's Technology and Innovation Council, based in New York. He is a former real estate and technology executive who now dedicates his time to researching the impact of technology on urban life and the way physical assets are designed, used, and valued. Dror, a very big welcome to Building Our Future.
Hi, Bert. Pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
So having read the introduction to your upcoming book, it's really exciting to see that so many of the themes you're tackling and dealing with are ones that we've discussed on the podcast, but you seem to be able to bring them all together in a very succinct and lovely way and put this kind of wrapper on as to why these things are all occurring at the same sort of time. How did you get to this type of thinking?
Yeah, the book is really an excuse for me to explore all sorts of things that interest me that frankly don't have anything to do with real estate directly, but have everything to do with how people live, how people work, how people eat, how people socialize, even how people die. All of these things ultimately impact physical assets. As you mentioned, you know, I've had quite a long career, like I'm turning 40 soon, both in real estate and also in technology and online media. And my work always somehow revolved around writing, even though I was never officially a writer. I was an executive, head of marketing, head of business development. Everything I did always started from really researching things and writing about them in order to explain them to myself, and usually sharing that with other people in order to inspire them or to recruit them or to convince them to give us funding for a project. And over the past few years, I started writing more and more about this intersection between the online and the physical world. Part of it started when I was in China, so I was based there for 10 years, developing commercial real estate projects. And in China, especially with our retail projects, I was always very involved in the technology world and kind of looking at, you know, sensors or mobile payment systems or location-based systems or generally kind of interesting business models for our retailers and tenants. But we never really called it like prop tech or real estate tech. We just kind of treated it as something that is unique to retail. But then I realized over the last 4 or 5 years that, you know, a lot of this stuff that started in retail and then maybe in hospitality is starting to trickle into office and multifamily and even industrial. So the categories that are more like classic, boring, kind of stable real estate. And as I started looking into it, I realized that there's a lot happening and that people don't seem to be aware of it. And I started sharing my articles and there was so much interest in it that at some point I said, okay, it looks like I have to write a whole book about it because there's interest and there's so much more to say. And I would love the opportunity to dive into this topic and really spend a few months just thinking about it, not for the sake of a specific business, but really just to dive into the big picture.
So on that, you are an extremely active tweeter. Have you used that as a sounding board as some of these ideas have evolved?
A little bit. I mean, I think I'm better at writing longer articles. And I think particularly on LinkedIn, I mean, some of the articles I read they resonate much more than on Twitter. On Twitter, I think it's more of like a niche of people that are already interested and open-minded and quite knowledgeable. So it's a nice way to learn new things or to bounce ideas. But I think the biggest kind of feedback loop for me is LinkedIn or my newsletter, where I can get, you know, thousands of people kind of emailing me back and telling me what they're thinking about and also writing to me about stuff that they're actually building and what they tried and what worked and didn't work and maybe stuff that they're not comfortable sharing on social media.
It would be wrong to distill your book as or define your book as another real estate technology book. It seems to be much more than that, and you're particularly involved in the ideas that underpin the real value of real estate and how that is changing. What are the main macro trends that shaped this type of thought?
So there's two layers here. The layer that is closer to the ground, there we see technology redefining all the things that we take for granted in real estate and the way it is valued. So, I mean, from the idea of what a good location means or what is the meaning of location at all, to what does visibility mean, accessibility, how powerful is zoning in determining, you know, in fending away competitors or determining the use of your building or the buildings next door, and down to things like the limited access that new entrants have to capital and information. So each of these things historically defined the value of real estate assets and also defended their value against competitors and defended their owners against new entrants. Now, technology is now undermining or redefining each of these, which means that suddenly it's harder to make predictions and plans longer term. You suddenly see all sorts of companies, big and small, competing directly against one another because those small companies or new entrants, WeWork, for example, can suddenly tap into huge pools of capital and at the same time can tap into huge amounts of information that previously were only available based on, you know, relationships or kind of long-term experience within the industry. So the environment, the competitive environment is becoming much more dynamic. At a higher level, more from, you know, macroeconomic perspective, the nature of real estate itself as an asset is being redefined. So real estate traditionally within institutional portfolios is seen as an asset that generates relatively stable income, that has low correlation with inflation, protects you against inflation, has low correlation with other asset classes such as stocks and bonds, is relatively passive for the good assets because you can just hire a third-party manager, let's say if you're a pension fund or an insurance fund. So you don't have to think too much about it. You just have an asset that can suit one tenant today and a different tenant tomorrow. And now technology and this dynamism from the previous point is undermining real estate's ability to fulfill that role. So the cash flow from these new, more flexible models means, you know, people might make more money out of these assets, but the cash flow is much less predictable. So it's no longer that kind of 4%, 5% NOI every year, but it might be 8% one year and 3% another year, and it's much more cyclical. Second, it requires much more operation and many more trade-offs. So it's no longer enough to just say, hey, I own, let's say, an office building in the middle of London. I brought in Cushman & Wakefield to manage it and lease it, and, you know, I'm just going to collect my coupon every year. Now you have to think creatively. You have to decide who your building is for and who your building is not for, which was not something that real estate people did traditionally, which involves risk, which means that the dynamics that we already see in the hospitality world, where there's higher cap rates, more volatility of income, higher correlation with other operating businesses, not other assets, but really other businesses. All of these things are common in the hospitality world, and we're starting to see more and more of them in other real estate categories, such as office, multifamily, industrial.
So if we pick up on some of the macro points in that, you alluded to the fact that there is this institutional capital which is ultimately driving the real estate values. But if we look at a layer up, this institutional capital is also investing across all asset classes globally. Do you feel like they are being forced into real estate partly as a result of there not being the yields that they're used to, certainly in things like traditional investments like bonds, gilts, and even equities, and that we're what we're seeing in terms of the reshaping of a built environment in real estate is ultimately a byproduct of, you know, not just real estate sector, but the entire financial system and global allocations?
I'm delighted that you asked about that. That's even bigger picture, and I'm not normally asked about these things on real estate podcasts. But yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, we have currently an abundance of capital in the world. These pension funds and other institutional investors have new capital to invest every quarter, and it has to go somewhere. They cannot just sit on it. Now, they're all already fully allocated to anything that generates income, which means they have to keep going into real estate, and they have to keep going up their risk curve in order to try to make up for income that they already missed out on. Because many people, you know, like you and I, when we started working, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago, probably our pension provider, whoever it is, or even if it is ourselves, made an assumption about, you know, annual yield of these portfolios, and it was probably somewhere between 6% to 10%. And now when we're currently looking ahead, most wealth managers will probably tell you to expect 3 to 6%, which means that these pension funds, governments or private, have massive unfunded liabilities already. Like, they know that in 20 years they won't be able to meet their obligations, or even in 7 years. So they have to seek places that generate faster growth, which means taking more risk. At the same time, another kind of process that is happening in parallel and kind of has an interesting interplay with this is that when you look at growth investments or at venture capital investments, like investments in new businesses, in a sense, all the low-hanging fruit that technology could transform have already been picked. So over the past 20 years, the creation of these massive trillion-dollar, you know, software companies, or mostly software companies, or even software and hardware such as Apple, but still hardware, technology hardware, not real estate. I think that over the next 10 or 20 years, most of the growth that remains to be unlocked with technology is in other industries that obviously people avoided until now because there were easier things to do elsewhere. And these industries are industries that involve heavier assets, that are highly regulated, that are very difficult to change, and that have large and entrenched players. And this includes real estate and also other industries such as healthcare and logistics and education. And so all of that culminates in huge amounts of capital coming into real estate and seeking to transform it.
So let's move on to another theme in the book, which is the transition to a more operational style model within real estate. Now, this is very much customer driven, but ultimately enabled by technology. And I think it's hard to argue that this really is the shift of tide, and the momentum is all moving in this direction. But this operating model may not necessarily be what these institutional investors are wanting when they're looking for this new form of asset allocation.
Yeah, I mean, there's an issue there also. Once real estate, let's say if office becomes kind of more volatile, more correlated with other operating businesses, you know, if more offices are run like WeWorks and then they correlate more with a business, let's say like Starbucks, then in terms of asset allocation from a pension provider's perspective, is really asking himself, okay, does real estate still play the role that I originally assigned to it within my portfolio? And if not, then why am I allocating, you know, 15% of my investment to it? Maybe it should be 12, maybe it should be 20, but it's definitely a different role.
So I agree with that. But I think that the key from my perspective is it's not just real estate that is changing. Neither bonds nor equities are necessarily performing in the time-honored tradition that they have in the last 50 years. And I think it's just important that us in our real estate bubble step back and appreciate that it's not just our world that is changing. It's almost the entire global financial system.
Absolutely. And I mean, the book is not talking about, you know, the end of real estate or real estate becoming useless or valueless. Quite the opposite. Real estate is going to become probably more valuable than ever. But in order to extract that value, we will have to learn as an industry to do all sorts of things that we haven't done before. And not just to learn, but to adopt all sorts of corporate structure and funding structures that were not common in the kind of core real estate market. So again, office, multifamily, industrial. I think there's an idea that is not fully developed in the book that is growing on me, and maybe the next book will be about that. The real world is really coming back with a vengeance. You know, the last two decades were about software is eating the world, and I think the next two might be about the world eating software, which means that the prime example that I'm starting to see unfolding is Airbnb. So in theory, wonderful company, asset light, aggregated demand by creating a beautiful digital product, and turned all of these hundreds of thousands of real estate suppliers, real estate assets, into commodities, like things that Airbnb taxes. And Airbnb can decide where the actual demand flows. So the owners of the assets have very limited power in that world. But what we're starting to see is that if you don't control your demand, your supply, so if you don't own the asset or at least lease them, which are considered, you know, negatives in the view of Silicon Valley, then very quickly you see that new competitors or even old competitors can suddenly come in and they steal your suppliers and your customers as well. So you see Expedia and Booking and Marriott and Accor, all of them going into the home sharing game, and Airbnb is switching from profitability into losing money. Its growth is slowing and it's really struggling to respond. And we'll see how that plays out. But there's a hint there that, you know, maybe owning the assets is not really the worst thing you can do after all.
So can we call that phenomenon the counter disintermediation by the micro brand?
And I think the brand still matters. And again, in hospitality, there are brands already. Airbnb didn't invent that. And what's interesting in hospitality is that there's a separation between the entities that own the assets and the entities that own the brands and the distribution and the kind of customer-facing aspects of the business. But these two entities have something in common. So both, they usually have a common origin. They were a single company that split into two, such as Marriott and Host Hotels and Resorts. But also, even the brand itself, even if it is asset light, it's not a pure aggregator like Airbnb. It has management agreements in place or franchise agreements in place. So its supply is still exclusive, even if it doesn't own the building. And often it also just leases the building, I think more commonly in Europe than in the US.
So you reference the fact that assets which are subject to operating models typically trade at higher cap rates, therefore lower values than assets subject to traditional 25-year style leases. Do you think that's an assumption which is under threat already? And I'm thinking specifically from my experience in the UK buy-to-let environment, where investors seem to be increasingly comfortable with transferring the risk from covenant to granularity of income and visibility of underlying data performance.
Yeah, I think, the good news is that in terms of the income as a whole, it's not going to be lower. It's probably going to be higher. But it might be, again, more volatile, or it might be divided into two streams. One, just like in hospitality. So the REITs still collect something that is relatively stable out of the asset. And that goes into investors that are looking for something stable and not looking for high returns. And then there's kind of a premium on top of it that goes to the C-corps, the brand corporations. And that income is more volatile, but it also grows faster. And it's suitable for other types of investors that are happy to buy, you know, shares in Marriott, but not to buy shares in Host Hotels and Resorts, or that they buy both, but like for different purposes. So I think we are going to see more of that in multifamily or built to rent, as well as in office and elsewhere. So there's currently the operating layer in office and housing is currently not thick enough, I think, to suit what people want. And someone will have to fill that gap. And I think structurally, it will be difficult for most existing landlords to just add those layers that they are missing for various reasons.
So do you see a world where we're going to have increasingly siloed pools of capital? So for instance, institutions continuing to invest in the assets with VC and the operating platforms and possibly something in between, maybe private equity on the asset plus OpCo model, or is it an entirely new form of capital going to emerge which deals with the whole stack?
No, I think that we will see the emergence of new models and new ways to arrange the capital stack. We're seeing that already happening. So in the world of co-living, for example, we see operators such as Medici or Common here in the US going into different investors for different purposes. So they raise money at the platform level into what you would call an opco, but it's a little more than a traditional real estate opco because, again, it hires slightly different types of people and it might invest more in technology than a traditional real estate opco. And that goes to one group of investors and often venture capital investors. And then they have these other separate funds that they raise in order to actually buy the assets or even sign the leases for the assets. So investors that are happy to finance a 20-year lease in order to get a coupon of some sort. But again, much lower risk. They have the lease itself as collateral, which is something that you don't have when you just invest in a startup or an opco. So we're seeing that happening.
Do you think we're going to see a change in perception of technology and how it relates to its application in real estate? And by that, I mean, I think in its the first iteration of PropTech was very much technology platforms that were human resource light. Do you think there's a growing acceptance that increasingly technology is going to require a growing human element, so there will be technology-led services rather than just platforms and dashboards per se?
Yeah, I mean, we see already that the biggest companies that were created in this space, you know, whether it's WeWork or Airbnb or others, neither of them invented some amazing transformative technology. Now, they integrated all sorts of things that already existed in a way that addressed customers' needs better than anyone else in the real estate industry. So I think that the biggest players will be those that can integrate and make use of things that already exist. They don't necessarily have to invent anything. Now, it doesn't mean that we will not continue to see lots of prop tech and things that aim at making, you know, operations a little better, saving time, saving money on headcount, you know, improving the quality of the air or the speed of the elevator or, you know, preemptive maintenance and all of these things. They're definitely necessary. But the dynamism that is coming into the industry, though, means that this would not be enough. Classic kind of strategy theory, Michael Porter, he distinguishes between operational effectiveness and strategy. Now, historically, real estate was governed by operational effectiveness. What it means is I bought a building, as long as I operated it better than someone else, which means, you know, I made sure that my bills are a little lower than someone else, that the elevators are running, you know, that I follow all the best practices, I was good. I didn't need to do anything else in order to succeed. Strategy means that it's no longer enough to just take care of your own asset, but you have to constantly respond to what other people are doing and to compete in a way that requires trade-offs and requires long-term commitment of resources to initiatives that take longer time to bear fruit. So not just to cut costs, but to like invest in new and innovative things in order to differentiate yourself. Now, this differentiation is needed because real estate is becoming more dynamic, because people have more options, because different assets suddenly create supply that used to be restricted to other assets. So if people can suddenly have a co-working space in their in a shopping mall or in their multifamily project or in a converted restaurant, it means that the traditional office landlord now faces more competitors. The fact that people can have quick access to information about options that are available to them also means that they have more options. Even if all those buildings were there before, if they were not easy to find, they didn't exist. Today, they exist. The fact that all these models enable customers to switch much more frequently between buildings, again, makes the whole battlefield more dynamic, which means that the landlord has to constantly compete for the customer, not just to do it every 10 years when it's time to renew the lease. And, you know, you throw in a sweetener and the deal is done.
So with the increased breakdown in things like zoning and use classes, as we call them in the UK, and the creation of new sub asset classes like co-working, co-living, etc., accepting that this normally comes with an increased operational burden, it seems that there's now more than ever a real opportunity to kind of put a unique stamp on a piece of real estate, whether you're an investor or a developer. Do you see this as a golden age for innovation within real estate?
Absolutely. I mean, innovation now is not just possible, but it's, you know, it's necessary. And again, it's not enough to just build a building. Even something like co-working, which is considered already some sort of a niche within real estate, if you type co-working for into Google, you'll see all the ways in which it completes that sentence. Co-working for women, co-working for lawyers, co-working for media artists, co-working for this, co-working for that. There's so many other little sub asset classes in there that allow people to generate a premium on top of the building, but again, requires more risk, requires more hands-on operation, and requires much more effort and creativity than before.
So you see, that's interesting, because I think we're yet to see, particularly in the UK, the real proliferation of specialist co-working platforms. I can't really think of an example where I've seen an attempt to bring together a specific industry under one co-working umbrella. Do you think that's just a London thing or a UK thing, or is this something which is just yet to come?
I think we're seeing signs of new kind of more focused operators emerging. But even in the mainstream or so-called mainstream of flexible office, we're already seeing some distinctions emerge. So, you know, if 20 years ago there was like Regus and that was like kind of a category, and, you know, there was them and the office center, or the executives, I don't know, a few competitors that were all kind of very similar.
Yeah.
Today, you know, there's a difference between the Office Group and Regus and WeWork and Convene. Each one of them offers a very different experience at a different price point to different people, and all of them are good. Like, there's nothing wrong with one or the other. But it's starting to be a little more, again, like in the hospitality market, where, you know, companies can ultimately have multiple brands. And even in that market, it's sometimes hard to tell the difference between all the brands, but some of them are pretty clearly defined.
So if you were a young founder of a real estate startup, would you be looking to get involved in assets, technology, operating platforms, or a mixture of the above?
I think a combination of the two. I think the interesting challenge for the next few years is to figure out, like, we know that there's demand for co-living and for co-working. You know, WeWork, whether it's worth $47 billion or $5 billion, the demand for it is very, very clear. The challenge now is how to figure out the right capital structure, the right type of business in order to deliver that value proposition that the market clearly wants. So I think mixing traditional real estate capital, both debt and equity, with venture capital or just private equity business capital, I think is a very interesting challenge, and that's where I would spend my time. I think more generally, I would just spend my time becoming a more interesting person. If you want to know real estate, like, you know, study literature, study history, study sociology, anthropology, figure out how people behave and, you know, what makes them happy, and go and see, you know, what's missing and address that.
So are we going to see new disruptive forms of financing, whether that's an evolution of some form of blockchain-enabled currency or crowdfunding, or will it just be a more simple evolution of the existing capital structures, or something completely different?
I think they're definitely, they're definitely meaningful. I think crowdfunding, you know, it started with people, you know, funding projects that are worth $500,000 or $5 million, but today they can fund $20 or $50 million projects and equity checks, which means that they're starting to compete with the lower end or even low to middle end of traditional private equity real estate providers. So they're starting to eat into categories that previously were restricted only to people that had the relationship and the track record. So to go back to your question about how wonderful it is to be an innovator these days, it's even more wonderful because today, if you have an inspiring idea that makes sense and you can convince a bunch of people that it's valid, you can raise a lot of money that, you know, even 5 years ago, there was just no chance that you'll ever get from anyone, unless, you know, you worked for 10 years somewhere very reputable, and, you know, and built a reputation. Today, the ideas themselves are powerful enough. And if you build your case, there's enough capital to back you. So I do think that these things that look kind of marginal and small are already meaningful and will be even more meaningful in the future.
So we've made it almost half an hour without mentioning it, but I'm going to break that now. WeWork, what's gone on? Do you think this is going to have an impact on people's ability to raise equity, either for real estate technology or real estate operating businesses?
I mean, it is going to have an impact, but I think it's a positive impact. I mean, the fact that you shouldn't raise venture capital in order to finance real estate capex, real estate leases, and real estate acquisitions is something that many of us knew years ago already. And frankly, even Adam Neumann knew it. And I think WeWork's plan was to go public, like to grow quickly with that capital, knowing that it's not sustainable. Then go public, raise the money that they need, and then slow down and change the model and go towards a more, you know, sustainable path. Unfortunately, they got their legs crossed on the way there, and they stumbled before they managed to raise money and change. And so now they'll have to change before the IPO. So, I mean, they had their own SoftBank IPO, you know, they got the money that they planned to get anyway, and now they're going to change course. For better or worse, you know, co-working is an extremely operationally intensive business. And to do it well and to make money, you have to tighten the belt and you have to stop running and you have to be very discerning with the leases that you sign, even if you do sign leases. And that's something that WeWork hasn't been doing. And frankly, their investors encourage them not to do it, which is part of the tragedy of the story. You know, SoftBank is the one that came to WeWork, to Adam Neumann, you know, Masayoshi Son came to him and said, oh, you think you're crazy? You're not crazy enough. Take whatever you plan, do it 10x, and then, you know, just keep running, and, you know, I'll keep funding you. And then they said, oh, wait, why did you do this? You know, let's, and anyway, they ended up owning 80% of the company at a better valuation and kicking the founder out. So, I mean, from their perspective, it's not necessarily a bad outcome, even though everyone looks at it now as like, you know, they're the biggest losers, but they're still in a position to, but it will take time.
Yeah, I've seen some theories flying around that this was all part of the genius SoftBank master plan.
Yeah, my friend Packy McCormick tweeted something about it. I don't think it's necessarily an evil master plan, but they definitely considered it as a downside scenario. You know, we'll push them towards an IPO. If they IPO at $47 billion or $30 billion, good for us. If they don't, you know, we have the money to come in and clean up, money that we plan to put into the company anyway. So instead of putting it in at a $47 billion valuation, we'll put it into the $5 to $8 billion valuation and continue from there. So, yeah, I mean, you know, money makes the world go round.
Well, Adam has been reasonably well looked after, so I'm sure life will continue for him.
Yeah, I think that he could have, I mean, he made a bunch of unforced errors that are unfortunate, I think, and particularly because they don't have much to do with the business itself. They just have to do with perception and silliness. I personally think that they still could have IPO'd maybe at $25 billion if all of this extra Adam Neumann noise wasn't there, just on the merits of the business, which are, you know, a stretch to begin with. But I think in this market, they could have gotten away with something. But once the spiral began of all the negative news, and then it just, you know, he became like the Donald Trump of real estate, basically. You know, it doesn't matter what he'll do. No one's going to like it anymore.
So, Drew, when can we look forward to getting our hands on your book?
So the book's already available for purchase on Amazon, on Barnes & Noble, Waterstones in the UK, and all the other major booksellers. The actual copies will start shipping in a couple of weeks. I think the Kindle copy will be ready in a few days, which might already be after you publish this. So sometimes within November.
And I'm sure if we follow you on Twitter, you'll keep us up to speed that way.
Absolutely.
So we've got our last three questions to wrap things up. And we start off with, can you please recommend us a book which has helped shape your thoughts when it comes to your role within the built environment?
I like to read a lot of history. So, you know, financial history, monetary history, military history. It's hard to pick one book. And I think there's the classics of business classics. Again, Michael Porter on strategy, or Clay Christensen on innovation.
Our second question, which may be equally as difficult to pin down, is what is your favorite building?
My favorite building, well, maybe the Orsay Museum in Paris. Just the grandeur and the light and the fact that it's filled with so much civilization. And also that it's next, like across the river from the Louvre, which is kind of more popular. And kind of like the Orsay, not that it's neglected, it's very popular as well, but just like there's something about it that feels a lot more like, okay, this is where the real good stuff is.
And that brings us to our final question, which is which innovation or real estate oriented tech company would you most recommend that we keep an eye out in the coming months and years?
I have to say WeWork. That would be the most interesting answer. I think they're still in an amazing position to make a huge impact on this industry, and I really hope that they will, because it'll be too sad if they don't. I told them a month ago, and they ended up doing it, that, you know, there's no more We. The end of We. Bye-bye. Back to WeWork. An office provider focused on, you know, providing a great experience for tenants. No longer. No need to elevate the world's consciousness. Just being a great office provider is enough.
Well, that's good enough for me. That brings us to an end, Drew. Thank you very much for coming on. I shall look forward to reading your book in full in the coming months. And thank you again.
Thank you again, Bert. I had a great time.
Given the change we see happening around us in the built environment, and the many fascinating conversations I've had on this podcast, I commend Drew's ability to draw up a macro wrapper to explain the various constituents of this change. As ever, if you've enjoyed this episode, please do recommend the show to a friend or colleague. It's hugely appreciated. Until the next time, thank you for listening.